You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Monster House presents.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
When we started Monster Talk back in 2009, I wanted to get Darren Nash on because he was one of the few scientists I knew who also kept up with cryptozoology. He helped us make many connections, such as to his former teacher, Dave Martell, who taught us about pterosaurs and the legendary Ropa of Papua New Guinea. Darren has had several appearances here, and we're excited to have him back again to discuss a project he's doing, which is focused on the cryptids described in the writing of Bernard Heuvelmans. It's a big art project, and it's over on his Patreon page, which I will link to in the show notes. Darren's been working his butt off during the pandemic, including contributing to the newest David Attenborough BBC dinosaur series, Prehistoric Planet. I'll put links to that in the show notes as well. There are some big changes coming to Monster Talk soon, ones which we will introduce in our next episode, and we hope you like them because they're going to mean more content with more frequency. But for now, let's get one more old-school classic Monster Talk going, as after 12 years we wind up with what I've been thinking of as an absurdly long season one of this show.
Monster Talk.
Welcome back, Darren. So it's good to hear from you again. So
good to chat again.
Yeah, well, thank you for the invite, and it's a pleasure to hear both of your fine voices. Thank you.
Oh, yours too.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the last time we talked, we were making fun of Jurassic Park or Jurassic World or something like that, I think. Or I was making fun of it, and you were quite sensible.
that rings a bell.
Yeah. Which is typical, yeah.
So the reason I reached out to you is because you've got this new series you're doing on Patreon where you're doing artwork based on hypothetical cryptids of Bernard Heuvelmans. So I wanted to say, first of all, it's very impressive. I'm looking forward to the final project. But can you tell our listeners what's this about? What's going on with this? Where does it come from? Where are you going with it?
Yeah, thanks. A couple of years back, I started a thing on Twitter, Crypto Mega Threads, where I wanted to... Twitter's, I think, a great... Is it right to call Twitter a medium? It's a really good platform for telling long form stories in small chunks, because the curse of the infinite scroll means that, yes, on the internet, we're always prepared to keep on looking at another thing, you know, another bit of information. So I thought, if you break down a long, tedious story into 1,000, you know, easily digestible bite size, you know, sentence size fragments, then, you know, every idiot is going to read that. And then, started for fun. I just thought, let's tell the story behind one of the famous, you know, Loch Ness Monster photos. That really got legs. That became quite big, and I really enjoyed doing it. And I've done enough of those, broken down the backstory to a specific cryptozoological case, that I've been thinking, I should keep on coming up with long form stories that I can do this to. And then for a while, I've been thinking, I really quite like the fact that in 1986, the so-called father of cryptozoology, the founder of modern cryptozoology, Bernard Heuvelmans, various different pronunciations of his name, as you've alluded to, Blake. He came up with this long list of cryptids, and his summaries of them are quite short. And I thought, wouldn't it be fun to actually go through them point by point? So I thought, as a Twitter mega thread, let's do that. You know, each entry gets you know, like a single tweet and a single image. But I thought, well, I don't want to keep on recycling other people's artwork. I want to do my own artwork. And therein lies the problem, because if I draw all 125-ish cryptids, I can't remember how many are in the list, 138, something like that. Wow. I'm looking at the list now. Yeah, I thought, wouldn't it be fun to I've just about developed, due to other projects, I've developed just about enough skills in various pieces of software to composite my illustrations, so you sort of have them overlapping. I really enjoy these images where you have, you know, like 50 different representative species in a group of animals, and you sort of see them standing next to each other at scale. So that, wouldn't it be fun to do that for the cryptids? And therein lies the backstory to this ridiculous project, which it takes me, if I were to sit down and do it full time, it would take me like 3 days to do a single drawing. And I don't have the opportunity to do it full time. It's the odd hour here and there. So we're talking about like years and years and years of work that I'm putting into this in the background.
Right. But, because of your completely unambitious other work.
Quite. I'm not exactly sat around twiddling my thumbs. So, yes, this is another background project that I shouldn't have taken on, but now I'm too deep to sunk time fallacy. I can't give up on it now.
My only follow-up would be that you could eventually produce a single composite image that would be along the lines of, you know, some of those George Perez comics where he's got all the heroes and villains in one giant picture.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Or like Sergeant Peppers or something.
Or like Sergeant Peppers, yeah.
It will look exactly like that. It will be like, it's so big because if it's 140-ish creatures, many of which are obviously large objects, it will be a large thing, and it would work well as like a big mural style landscape formatted poster. So that's how I imagine it. A thing that's like 2 meters long, which hopefully I can do. And I also think it's probably worth putting it out in book form. So, like, you'll have your illustration on one page and your text on the other side, and the text will be similar to what I've done in other projects, which we've discussed before, like the Cryptozoologicon book I did with Mamo Kosman and John Conway, where first of all we say why cryptozoologists developed this particular view of the creature, what they based it on, you know, the key accounts. And then finally, you know, how do we actually interpret this take on it? What's going on here? What does it actually mean? So there's easily enough scope there for sort of 1,000 words for each cryptid.
Very exciting.
So more than 100,000 words. Wow. What?
Easy.
Very ambitious. Darren, we've not going to go through all 138 cryptids, but we're wondering if we could talk about a select few of them. So to begin with, could you tell us a bit about the giant beaver? And Blake has put a note here into the questions and said this one really amuses him. So
yeah, well, that really does, that particular creature gets right to the core of the issue here, which is that now, without rambling and meandering too much, you know, all three of us here will know that the as we've already kind of alluded to, Bernard Hoovermans is seen as the sort of air quotes father of cryptozoology, as the guy who kind of got mainstream pelts and paws, flesh and blood cryptozoology kind of off the ground. Obviously not the only person that did that. He is one of several people who wrote, you know, had a similar take on the subject.
Willie Lay, and then
exactly
Ivan Sanderson. I think I agree with you though. He is, if you had to pick a father, he's a good candidate.
Yes. Now, on the one hand, you know, this is the tangent. This isn't the time for it. But today, I think if you did a straw poll among younger people who regard themselves as interested in cryptozoology, I don't think they necessarily would even have heard of him or know of his work, because for various reasons, cryptozoology is clearly drifting away into something else. That's a whole nother subject. I don't want to touch on that now. I don't want to discuss that now. I just want to touch on that point. However, to those of us who think of it as this flesh and blood, field that essentially started out as, hey, everyone, let's try and keep this within mainstream zoology, Hoovermans is seen as, accurately or not, he is seen as this qualified zoologist who tried to make the subject a part of mainstream zoology. That was his aim. So the thinking among those of us who know that is, well, he's the guy who's approaching it from the serious natural history zoological angle. So therefore, his cryptids that he endorses and his interpretations of the cryptids he's endorsing is therefore, you know, relatively as empirical as you can be in this subject. So presumably, you know, the animals in his list are going to be the targets, the cryptozoological targets that are, that we generally, you know, again, if you did a straw poll among people who regard themselves as cryptozoologists, you would think they're creatures, hypothetical creatures that are generally have some fairly, you know, firm backup as there potentially is a real creature here. You know, your various sea monsters that have been described by more than one person and your yetis and that kind of thing, right? However, right, and this is where we come back to the giant beaver, it's like his list is worryingly odd because he does have the classic cryptids in there, the superstars that have always been regarded as firm targets of the field. But then he just has an entry in there where he'll say, and on the giant beaver, he says, without actually reading it, digging it out from the paper and reading it, he says something like, yeah, there's also this bunch of like weird North American creatures that are in the literature, and they include giant snakes, giant beavers, flying men, and a whole bunch of other stuff. And they might be real as well. And that's all he says in the entry, slightly less vernacular language than that. But he clearly read Lauren Coleman's, one of Lauren's several books on mysteries of the United States, you know, published in the 70s or 80s. And that, you know, there's Mothman and other sort of alleged winged humanoids in there. There's these giant snakes that aren't supposed to be native to North America at all. And there's the giant beaver. So, Lauren and Patrick Huige provided the most amount of detail on this alleged cryptid in their book from the 2000s, Field Guide to Lake Monsters and Other Mysteries of the Deep. I can't remember its exact title.
That was The Field Guide to Lake Monsters, Sea Serpents, and Other Mystery Denizens of the Deep.
And according to those researchers, Coleman and Huige, and I think probably their late colleague Mark Hall, there are, number one, indigenous accounts that describe a creature that sounds like Castoroides, a gigantic, a sort of black bear-sized beaver known as a Pleistocene fossil. And number two, there are accounts from the 1800s and early 1900s from various parts of North America that might pertain to sightings of a giant beaver. I remember in the Coleman and Huige book, they have a section on how the person who was the founder of Mormonism, is that Joseph Smith?
Yes.
Joseph Smith.
In Brigham Young, yeah. Yeah,
yeah. I think I'm thinking of, okay, think it's Joseph Smith, who apparently was a real advocate of the existence of the giant beaver. We're taking seriously the idea that Castoroides, the fossil beaver, was still extant somewhere in, I don't know if it was in the Salt Lake City region, but somewhere in that part of the US. And it's really hard to, I mean, yeah, obviously the skeptical take on this is, well, wait a minute, the indigenous accounts you have in mind don't really describe anything that sounds like Castoroides, and I'm not really convinced that the alleged eyewitness accounts from the 1900s, 1800s and 1900s really describe anything like that. But nevertheless, this creature is in there. And Hooverman's, again, seems to have been laissez-faire enough, kind of relaxed enough about it to say, yeah, I'm gonna chuck this in my list as well. So there you go. That's kind of why the giant beaver Castoroides is in there.
Interesting.
If I had to lodge a complaint, I'd say, where's the damn evidence?
Now, interestingly enough, we do know that Castroides, the giant Pliocene beaver, did not construct lodges nor dams.
Why would it? It's so big, right?
Yeah, this is a thing that particular lineage of beavers didn't do, unlike the modern.
Let's move on to the Chinese bear. Which yeah. I found very intriguing because I didn't realize that was in his list. And I've read parts of his book for, you know, research purposes, but I've never read end to end one of the what's the name of his big book? Is it On the Trail of Unknown Animals? Is that right? Or something like that.
On the Track. Yep.
On the Track, yeah. So I didn't realize the Chinese bear was in there, but that's not a cryptid the way we would normally think. It's more like a thylacine where it's a maybe he thought it was extinct, or do you know what's going on there? Why include that?
Yeah, he hasn't a lot of the things that are in this list. So it's published in 1986 in the journal Cryptozoology. This particular article, he published a revised version in the mid 90s, I think 96, where he mm-hmm. changed some of his takes on certain of the cryptids. And Carl Schuker provided an updated and revised version in, I think, 1998. A lot of the creatures in here aren't necessarily in Hovelmans's other writings, or at least those that are available to us, because, as you probably know, many of his works remain untranslated from the French or weren't actually ever compiled into book form. The bear that we have in mind here, the Bei Xiong, this again is in keeping with what I said a moment ago about Hoovermans being slightly odd and inconsistent in terms of what he's actually endorsing as a cryptid, because this Bei Xiong, it's a pale colored bear from two provinces of China, Wuhan and I've forgotten the other one, and 10 Beijing, is that a province? Well, whatever, they're kept at Wuhan and Beijing. Those are cities, not provinces.
Right.
And 10 specimens of this bear have been kept in captivity, and there are taxiderm specimens of it. It's been scientifically described. It's been given a scientific name in 1977. It was called Selenarctos Xenonensis, I think. And so wait a second. Like, my understanding, according to Hovelmans's writings, are that a cryptid, a creature that is within the remit of cryptozoology, is an alleged creature that's known from anecdotal data of some kind. So people claim they've seen it, or people have stories about it, but we don't have specimens of this that demonstrate its, you know, biological reality, right? That's what a cryptid is. So if you're now talking about a bear that you've got dead specimens of, that you've got them in museums, and you've got live specimens in zoos, I'm like, that's not a cryptid at all. I mean, and there's a controversy about this animal as to what kind of bear it is, and that's why Hovelmans is kind of including it in his list. But where do you draw the line between, you know, that's the case for loads of animals. There's a huge number of animals where people have had disagreements over is it a species in its own right? Is it a subspecies of a known species? Is it a color morph of a known species? I mean, there's so many different examples of that kind of thing. And this bear falls into that camp. I'm pretty sure from the photos and the published descriptions that Bei Xiong is a pale variant of the Asian black bear. So there's a species called the Asian black bear. It's a known species. And like the American black bear, which is not particularly closely related to, but like that species, it has a pale-coloured population, which is pale due to, you know, peculiar genetics and maybe adaptation to a specific environment or what have you. And that's what we're talking about there. We're not talking about an animal that is known only from anecdote, is known only from stories. So to me, it's like, when you include that animal in the list, well, now, Dr. Hovelmans, you have opened the floodgates to like a huge number of forms of animal life of kind of slightly controversial technical zoological standing. They're not cryptids at all. And it seems odd to me that that was included in the list.
Well, speaking of where do you draw the line, a lot of big cats.
Where's he going with this? Where's he going?
Yeah. Well, I'm particularly interested in the blue tiger.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's along the kind of similar lines. Darren, it's a tiger. That wasn't my attempt at a joke. Although this one, yeah. So where do we say this is a cryptid or not? So there are a very small number of eyewitness accounts of what's been called the Fujian or Maltese. I forget why it's called Maltese because it's nothing to do with Malta. But a mythical blue tiger, a semi-mythical blue tiger seen in Fujian province. And a true properly blue, as in like, not, I'm not talking about like it's on the bluish side of orange, you know, like it fits within regular tiger anatomy, but no, a truly blue morph. I cannot remember the name of the key witness, but there's a key European hunter who observes this creature and describes it and wrote it up in a couple of books. And for me, I wouldn't say alarm bells are ringing, but it's kind of, I'm not convinced that there is a particularly robust body of observers that are reporting this animal. The observer concerned wrote a book on it and, kind of made a career out of saying, there is this blue tiger that I've seen. The best story is quite good about it because he's saying, it's a bit embarrassing that I've forgotten his name. I don't have any notes in front of me or anything. But the
that was work by Harry R. Caldwell and Roy Chapman Andrews. Their book, The Blue Tiger, was published in 1924.
The person concerned is saying that he's hunting tigers, and his Chinese assistant says to him, "Hey, look over there. There's a blue tiger," and he says, "No, that's a man. That's the only thing that could be wearing blue here in this jungle." I said, "No, really, look, it's a blue tiger," and it's sure enough there through the foliage. I saw the bright blue of the tiger, and call me a cynic or what have you, but when you find that someone writes one or two books on their favorite mystery animal.
If only he'd had some mechanism by which to capture or kill a specimen.
I think it's universally agreed by everyone who's written about it and by the observer that we're talking about here, is universally agreed that this would be, if it's real, this would be a color morph of a known species. Hmm. I think it's agreed that it would be, yeah, like a blue variant of the I don't know which subspecies of tiger specifically, presumably the Chinese tiger. So again is that a cryptid? I mean, maybe, because but maybe not, because again, written into the remit of what cryptids are is they're meant to be a form of distinct taxonomic status. I don't know. I mean, there has always been this ambiguity about whether we should include new color morphs or what have you. So,
right. I mean, you certainly can get, when it comes to domestic cats, bluish colored cats like Russian blues and Burmese cats. Mm. So, I can imagine it, you know, a type of gray or something. But anyway, speaking of cats, I'm also interested in the aquatic cat and mermaid. Can you tell us a bit about them?
Yes. So you're talking about the a large amount of Bernard Hooverman's work is not particularly well known in English speaking nations because it wasn't ever translated into English, and he wrote a book in French. I've forgotten the name of it, but it's basically about mystery cats of Africa.
Les félins encore inconnus d'Afrique. The still unknown felines of Africa.
And he says that throughout tropical Africa, no, in fact, not just tropical Africa, across a huge swathe of Africa, east to west, north to south, people of many different ethnicities and countries talk about because we always have to remember Africa is a vast nation of over, I think it's over 40 mm-hmm. countries. People in many countries talk about seeing aquatic animals of some kind that have a sort of scaly covering, a short head mm-hmm. and protruding fangs. And there's many different local names for these kinds of creatures. The one that's best known in the cryptozoological literature is Dingonek, which is used in Kenya, I think, for this kind of animal. And Hooverman says that these kinds of creatures are the accounts concerned. People are describing aquatic mammals, aquatic furry mammals, mm-hmm. not like naked skinned animals like manatees or dolphins. They're describing furry animals where the fur is kind of clumped together to form this scale like look, and that they are describing predatory mm-hmm. mammals. And he theorizes that these are aquatic saber-toothed cats, which are that's not a thing that we know about, right? There's no that we don't mm-hmm. we have like many fossils, we have many fossil species of saber-toothed cat, but we don't have any that we know were aquatic. There's no indication that any of them were specialized for aquatic habits. So a thing that's really, really common in the cryptozoological literature, and especially in Hooverman's writings, is that cryptids are not just said to be, this is a saber-toothed cat. They're also mm-hmm. said to be specific new kinds of animals that have got quite an elaborate and novel evolutionary backstory. So Hooverman says, given that saber-toothed cats competed with the conical-toothed cats, like, you know, the group that includes, you know, lions and tigers and whatnot, he says, wouldn't it make sense that, mm-hmm. oh, and by the way, the saber-toothed were surely like quite an encumbrance, quite difficult for them to make a normal living with, especially when they had to compete with other predators. Isn't it likely that they therefore mm-hmm. evolved in some other direction that isn't necessarily supported by the fossil record? What about the idea that they did actually become aquatic? And if this was so, wouldn't it make sense that they kind of, you know, evolved flippers and a paddle-like tail? You know, we already know that pinnipeds, seals, sea lions and walruses, they are aquatic members of carnivora. They're part of the same group as bears and weasels. So what about the idea that cats could have done this also? And yeah, he says that all of these aquatic monsters across Africa are this kind of creature. He says a similar thing actually happened in South America, and that explains various aquatic monsters from South America. And so if you accept this, and I think only a handful of people ever took it seriously, but if you do accept it, then it means that included within the pantheon of cryptids, according to Hooverman's, are these kind of walrus-like saber-toothed tropical aquatic saber-toothed cats. So again, that's taken seriously by Hooverman's. And just to finish very briefly on this, my kind of like favorite, the secret trick I have up my sleeve, which no one else is ever able to deploy when it comes to cryptozoological accounts, is go back and read the original accounts, right? that's the answer to like any way. I'm the only person that's ever figured this out. Go back and read the original accounts. I'm being, of course, extremely facetious. Sure. Yeah. And if you do that, you basically never find that the accounts support this, like, I've referred to this several times as a house of cards. It's like Hooverman's and his fellow theorizers, they built these like massive, elaborate, grandiose houses of cards, many, many, many cards, based on this mm-hmm. paper-thin foundation. And it's like, go back and read the original accounts. They don't describe what people think they did describe. And the accounts concern the alleged, you know, what's the origin for this? It's people coming up with some very, very vague descriptions of aquatic animals seen at distance, which don't sound like mm-hmm. cats at all. Or it's based on indigenous accounts where we're getting some weird, like, sort of 10th generation version told through many different, you know, interpretations and translations. And we don't actually know the context of the original story from the people who, you know, originally had it as a legend or a tall tale, not as a straightforward eyewitness mm-hmm. account.
is the kind of thing, it's fantastic. And it would be wonderful for the world, if the world was like this, it'd be so amazing. You know, if every mm-hmm. little evolutionary thing that could happen did happen, how nifty. But, you know, that's, I don't think reality sort of comports, does it? But that's it is yeah. it's fun to imagine. I think your illustrations, you know, bring that home really nicely. So it's cool to see. Well, if you took this seriously, here's what it would look like. That's nifty.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about, the stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or say, Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like I've seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose. It kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand yeah. and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and Wagon.
We've got a podcast recommendation I think will be really fun and or useful for Monster Talk listeners. I Know Dino, the big dinosaur podcast.
Studying dinosaurs can teach us about the prehistoric world, but also the world of today. For example, migration patterns of dinosaur lineages can tell us about the Earth's changing continents.
Climate models of dinosaur ecosystems help us understand global warming.
Studying dinosaur diets can help show the link between plant and animal evolution.
Talk about paleo. In many dinosaur injuries, paleopathologies are the first known occurrences of diseases.
A new episode of I Know Dino comes out every week with new dinosaur discoveries you won't hear about anywhere else. You can find I Know Dino on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
But let's turn to American sloth. Darren, why are Americans so lazy?
Don't say that about yourself.
Yeah, when Europeans first, you know, became aware of North American fauna, there was, you've surely heard of this, so referring to living animals, there was this idea that North America was basically,
oh, you mean like during Jefferson's time? Yes
yeah,
like,
yeah, this like, idea, so, I forget what it was called, there was a name for this hypothesis that North America was rubbish, it was really poor.
Is the French Buffon, maybe? It was the degeneracy of American
fauna.
That's
it. Yeah. Yes, thank you. That's exactly it. Degeneracy.
It's in there somewhere. Nice. I just got to rattle it around.
American degeneracy. So, yeah, all of your animals are terrible. They're all small. They're all weak versions of our fine, upstanding, proud European versions. And not to, obviously, let's not start talking about, you know, what Europeans said of Australasian,
Australian.
That was even horribler, wasn't it? Even more bizarrely biased. Mm. So, you know, obviously today we can, you know, feel quite good about ourselves saying how ridiculous this idea was. But the idea that North America might have something as exciting as sloths, that giant sloths, mind you, wasn't dreamt of. And of course, most of us are familiar with the story about Jefferson. Thinking that Megalonyx was actually a great cat, and that the giant sloth claws were actually the claws of a cat that must have stood about, oh my god, elephant sized lions.
Wow.
Yes. And today, the sloth world is exciting in terms of how many sloths we know were living in North, Central, and South America until the end of the Pleistocene, until about 13,000 years ago ish, doing many different things at many different body sizes with quite an exciting range of behaviors. And that kind of like new, fast-moving, developing world of sloths doesn't necessarily reflect what's been said in the cryptozoological literature. That kind of harkens back to a sort of more traditional view that sloths of several kinds might have hung on in remote South America. I mean, in the cryptozoological mm-hmm. ideas about sloths surviving to modern times really do hark back to the first European exploration of South America, early 1800s, where they are finding sloth remains in Patagonia and Chile and saying that these animals are clearly, they've only just gone extinct. They clearly overlapped extensively with people. All of this stuff, of course, is now hasn't proven to be exactly,
Yeah. I mean, in their defense, they did find what skin and bones in a cave that they didn't know how to date at the time, right? So it seemed plausible. But it looks like a lot of this Mapinguari, the sort of folk monster of Brazil in the Amazonian, all that talk is coming from. It seems like one guy, David Oren, who's, I think, an ornithologist, who as you say in your text, seems to only talk about the facets of those sightings or the story that match his idea that this was really a surviving giant sloth. But, the monster is very clearly folklore. It's got a giant mouth in its belly. And we talked about this in episode 194 with the paleontologist Dr. Richard Farinha.
I know Richard. He's an
good memory.
He invited me to barbecue, and I'm just dying to become wealthy enough to travel down there and have some. So,
wow. I sense the conflict.
Still got a few on the.
Well, sorry, I was going to say I sense a conflict as to whether you should say sloth or sloth, because this, of course, is the great lament of the Americas.
It is. I was trying to humor you.
I really appreciate it. Yeah.
Between the three of us, we've all got different pronunciations.
Karen, what's the official Australian pronunciation?
We say sloth.
Oh dear.
Yeah.
Wow.
Goodness.
Laying the side down.
But we say aquatic. So, that's why it's always funny to me when people say, you think that I'm a British English, because the different Englishes are just so separate, so different, and really evolved. So they're quite different. And I guess if you're not exposed to them, then it's difficult to differentiate. But we've still got a few creatures on the list that we'd like to look at. And wolves of the Sahara.
Mm.
Tell us about them.
Yeah, I'm not sure from where he does identify his sources, but Bernard Hoovermans says that various people across the Sahara talk about a wolf-like animal, and there's various local names for it, and he suggests that there could be some wolf-sized, brownish, desert-dwelling, wolf-like canid. So it's not a particularly remarkable cryptid if it does exist. But here's the spin on this, and I don't know if this is new to you, but this is a thing where he's actually completely right. This isn't controversial now. We know for absolute certainty that this was only published officially, I'm going to say, around about 2008-ish, there are wolves in the Sahara. So it turns out that the wolf is not, excluding the Americas, the wolf isn't just European and Asian. There are wolves across northern Africa, in Egypt, as far south as Djibouti, I think, Eritrea. Now, people for a long time, since Victorian times, have been very confused as to the status of a particular kind of wolf-like jackal. There's a North African and European large jackal called the golden jackal, which looks quite wolf-like. And some populations of, incidentally, over the last couple of decades, this species, the golden jackal, has been spreading northwards throughout Europe. When I was a kid, it was around the fringes of the Mediterranean, and today it's as far north as, I think, Hungary. It's certainly been photographed in kind of like snowy places in cold and, you know, cold northern Europe. So this animal has staged a sort of like European invasion over the last few decades.
Wow.
But so that's
I did
a cool
not
story.
Know that.
Yeah, Canis aureus, the golden jackal. There's some populations of the golden jackal that are very wolf-like. And yeah, people said, wait a minute, could it actually be that rather than being wolf-like populations of the golden jackal, some of these are actually misidentified wolf populations?
Does the jackal run or does the jackal lope? Moving on.
They do both.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Keep that under the table.
So cut a long story short, yes, it turns out that some of these wolf-like canids of northern Africa are actually members of the wolf species. Now, the wolf Canis lupus, over the course of the 20th century, generally thought to be, you know, present throughout North America, present throughout Europe and the whole of Asia, and now northern Africa as well. This is probably a species complex. It probably contains actually sort of three or four different species belonging to different branches of the wolf domestic dog, you know, part of the dog family tree. Like even in North America, you know, the eastern wolf might be a different species from the that's a tangent. Don't want to go down that way, because that involves the red wolf and it involves the hybrid between the coyotes and the eastern wolves. But North African wolves, Saharan wolves are a thing, and it could well be that this creature included as a cryptid in Hoofman's list does include that actual real taxonomic form. Yeah, so that's quite an exciting, a success for cryptozoology.
Yeah.
Hey, well done. I found one.
Well, we always have to mark this when we find them, for real. That's good. That's good. Well, this sort of blends nicely into talking about black dogs. I don't want to go too deep because obviously, first of all, we've covered black dogs quite a few times on the show, but you did a really great post, a really nice long post about black dogs on Tetzu. Do you want to talk about that?
Oh, thanks. I'll try and keep it brief, but I've been wanting to do this for quite a long time because I find this a fascinating phenomenon, the idea that mostly in Europe, but in other parts of the world, including in the US, including in parts of countries of South and Central America as well, and then cross-continental Europe, people claim these encounters with giant, shaggy-coated, black spectral hounds, typically seen in rural locations. Typically, they're said to be, you know, really big, like the size of a sort of small cow or as tall as a table, and they're said to be really scary. And I like the legend. I like the fact that they are included sometimes in books that do cover mystery animals. In Janet and Colin Board's famous Alien Animals book, a really good source of reports on all kinds of things that most people would regard as cryptids, that the black dog is kind of included in there as if it's on par with, you know, lake monsters and Bigfoot and whatnot. But is also at the same time included in books on ghosts and the paranormal, as if it sort of should belong to that club instead. And the encounters do sound more like ghosty stories. They sound more like, you know, the creature faded from vision as the person was looking at it, or it disappeared mysteriously, or it appeared in a setting that's not at all in keeping with the cryptid. You know, like there's an account of a young woman sat at the edge of the bed, and a black dog appears in the bedroom and walks out through the door and disappears as it goes into another room. And they're said to have glowing eyes, like most typically red, which of course is another sort of staple of mystery animal accounts, or phantom style animal accounts. So what's the deal there? Is this in the article that I wrote, Tetrapod Zoology, I did suggest the possibility that could it actually be people experiencing something weird in the environment? You know, they're being affected by something in the environment and thinking they're seeing a dark object, which they then describe as the black dog, which is, you know, similar to the scientific explanations that have been put forward for, you know, ghosts and other phantoms. You know, maybe people are experiencing infrasound or electromagnetic phenomena or something along those lines, and thinking, air quotes around thinking, you know, they're sort of perceiving something at the edge of vision that they interpret as a phantom. I did offer that explanation, but I'm really interested in the idea that some cryptozoologists have decided to say, well, wait a minute, could this actually be a cryptid? Could people actually really have been seeing these things? And could they be real flesh and blood animals? Which I would think it's clear from what I've said so far that that's kind of a non-starter. But nevertheless, people have suggested that. And I wanted to discuss that and see where it goes. It doesn't go very far, but nevertheless, I wanted to.
Yeah.
Speaking of dogs, or at least giant hound-like creatures, we should talk about your work with Le Bête d'Auvergne.
Very good.
Bon he Dieu. Just likes to say it.
Bernard du Vermont.
Yes. Yes. La Bête. The Beast of Gévaudan, which is an absolutely remarkable tale. I mean, yeah, for people that haven't
heard. Well, the whole animal was quite remarkable.
Yeah. Oh, I get it. I'm always a few steps behind.
I knew he was going to go there.
Its tail and the rest of it was remarkable. But yeah, the fact that there was this creature in medieval France that supposedly killed, I have forgotten the number. I don't know if either of you remember, but it's
variable, but more than 100 probably.
Yeah.
I think legitimately more than 100. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And they're blamed. And I think we can be quite confident that it might not be absolutely accurate that this one creature killed all these people, but the fact that it's said to have roamed the countryside, and there are these various different descriptions of it, and modern interpretations, modern attempts to explain the beast say that it could have been misidentifications of particularly dangerous wolves. Again, in keeping with what we're just saying about the diversity of wolves, some of the European wolf populations don't look exactly like wolves as we normally think of them. Some of them have got like unusual markings in terms of how much brown and how much black and how much white they've got on them, which could be consistent with some of the accounts of the beast. La Bête. Then you've got this claim that some aspects of the way in which the creature is described make it sound very different from a canid. You know, remember the dog family entirely. That some people have argued seriously in recent years that could it have been an escaped hyena or a lion. And there's this, I've forgotten the name of the book. There is one scholarly book published on it this century, which says that, it sounds like people were actually being attacked and killed by a lion wandering around the French countryside, which sounds absolutely remarkable. And also isn't consistent with the fact that people were able to sort of like put up a fight. And, you know, there's the story of the woman who climbed on its back and squeezed its testicles, and that caused the animal to like give up the attack. Well, if you tried that on a lion, I don't think you'd come out of that with a story.
I think
lions have like accidentally jumped on people and killed them dead. It's really hard to who. Oh, yeah, there, of course there are people that have survived lion attacks. But
breaking news, listeners: lions are dangerous.
Yes. Fact.
Interesting story anyway.
Yes. And then my
try something.
Yeah, I think and what Hooverman's touches on, at least, and again I don't have the text in front of me, but what he alludes to, and again we explored this in the Cryptozoological, in the book I did a few years back, and I have explored in this new project, is based on some of the drawings done at the time and some of the descriptions done at the time. Hooverman and others were prepared to endorse the idea that maybe this was actually something completely new. Think about it. If it's in his list, which is why we're talking about it, it's not in there. Mm-hmm. Like, an escaped lion or a population of like ravenous wolves, those aren't things that should be regarded as cryptids. It's in his list because he's saying that, hey, everyone, this could actually be something completely new, some entirely new kind of carnivoran mammal. And there's these famous drawings that show it as this long, tailed, like, tufted tail at the end, striped, long-faced predatory mammal, which doesn't match anything known to science. Is it some new kind of, say, giant, like, cursorial, long-legged member of, like, the mustelid family, the weasel family? That's kind of what's implied. So that's actually what I've done. I've said, wow, that's in the Cryptozoologicon, we proposed a scientific name for it, Crypto. No, I can't remember the name. Okay, I can't remember the name. We came up with a new proposed scientific name for it. There's a couple of cryptozoological articles in the grey literature that do explore this. They say, could it have been some new kind of, entirely new kind of giant predatory mustelid unknown from the fossil record? The answer is no, but it's a fun idea and another example of this really extraordinary creature building that exists within cryptozoology.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Well, I think if we could look at one more creature, I think you've written already about weird dolphins and whales.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. So there's a good healthy list of alleged crypto cetaceans. And in his 1968 book, which was the famous kind of like follow-up to On the Track of Unknown Animals, his In the Wake of the Sea Serpents, Hooverman says that we really should take seriously the idea that people throughout history have seen giant unknown sea creatures. And he points to the fact that a long list of people that we should, kind of listen to, like people who know what they're talking about, marine biologists and other sort of serious writers, they've endorsed this as well. And indeed, is it not the case that boring ordinary zoologists and biologists are totally prepared to accept the existence of a list of weird cetaceans that have been observed and yet remain unknown from specimens? So therefore they're in the same ballpark, according to his argument, they're in the same ballpark as the great sea serpent and the super giant squid that he endorsed and so on. And he lists these various cryptocetaceans. They include a tall finned blunt headed animal seen on the Skye expedition to the Antarctic in 1902 or something, and a couple of peculiarly patterned tropical dolphins and killer whale type animals seen in the Red Sea and around the coasts of India and the Indian Ocean coast of Africa. He says, look, zoologists accept these animals, so why shouldn't they accept the sea serpent as well? And it's like, well, wait a minute, zoologists don't accept those animals. In fact, if you look at this this list of alleged cryptocetaceans, and this was actually one of the first things I ever really wrote about in cryptozoology. I did a long series of articles back in the early 1990s about mystery whale sightings. It's all of the accounts are, again, they're not as simple as we can be absolutely sure that it was a description of an unknown species. They are accounts that are, they have their own vagaries attached to them, or there's some ambiguity about the coloration that was concerned. And I don't think many people know that there's round about 100 living species of whales and dolphins. And on that list, there's going on, conservatively, there's something like 20 species that are only known from a handful of good, unambiguous eyewitness accounts, made by qualified observers, and which involve, good photography, good color photography. There's a long list of living whales and dolphins where even now we're still a bit unsure about what their exact appearance in life is like. Then you've got the fact that a lot of these animals, if you're a big marine animal and you're, a generalist in ecological terms, well, you've the world almost literally is your oyster. Animals like bottlenose dolphins, killer whales, blue whales, they occur globally. And there's this long list of things that make them really variable according to the exact conditions of, the lighting and the color of the sea. you know, they look very different in Antarctica as opposed to, you know, the Bay of Bengal or something. And then there's also subpopulations of these animals that also look really different. And for animals like, you know, the killer whale is the ultimate example of this. It's turning out that there's so much genetic variation, so much diversity within that group of animals that it might actually be multiple subspecies or species included in an animal like the killer whale. So as is often the case for wide-ranging animal species, the populations that we know best, the ones, so killer whales, you know, the ones that we've seen on TV or in parks or around the coasts of the USA or, you know, Western Europe or what have you, they are the best studied, most familiar populations. But weird ones that live, say, you know, in the Southern Ocean, in obscure bits of the Arctic or what have you, will look different. The eye patch is different. The actual animals can be like, the white bits of the killer whale can be tawny brown or yellow. So, yeah. So quite a few of the crypto whales on the list are, there's quite a few caveats in there, but they're sort of, you know, they're in that list of vagueness. It's like, are you sure you are actually describing something that could have been new rather than a local variant?
Yeah.
Of animals that are really poorly known and we just don't have as much information as we might like at this point. And I'm, you know, we're looking at this now in a very privileged age where we've got all this new data. Hoovermans is looking at reports from, you know, the mid 1900s when their knowledge was rudimentary. And I don't know why I said it that way. I think rudimentary is the more normal way of saying it. But where things like underwater photography and aerial photography and color photography are only just being employed in the study of wildlife, right? I mean, never forget that. It's like the whales weren't really appreciated in their true form until I think they were first photographed underwater. Big whales were, I think, the 1950s or 60s. So everything prior to that time, yeah, you've got to think of it in a kind of, they just don't have the data that today we have.
Well, right.
Fair enough.
And all the new stuff we see, like we'll see exciting new animals on Twitter or wherever we see videos, but usually those don't include things like, how big is this animal? You know, how deep are you when you're looking at this animal? How likely am I to see this animal in real life? You know, but we're seeing it for the first time. It's fantastic. I don't want to, you know, belittle the work of those people doing that research. It's fantastic. I mean, the amount of biodiversity in the real world, you know, it doesn't demand that we create more, but yet it seems to be a very human impulse.
Yeah.
We do, yeah.
In all seriousness, though, what are you working on? What's going on that you might want to talk to listeners about?
Well, the thing that has kept me busy over the past couple of years is, of course, the Apple TV Plus / BBC Studios TV series Prehistoric Planet, which
popular
was
here.
Great, very privileged to have worked on that. Thrilled with the final product, and that's the thing that's mostly kept me busy. But in the background, I have managed to finish various technical projects and various books. So, two books in particular, Mesozoic Arts, which I edited together with my good friend and colleague Steve White. It's published by Bloomsbury Press and will be out later this year. So Mesozoic Art, it's a giant book of up-and-coming new paleo artists, so our kind of new cutting-edge vision of what animals of prehistoric times were like. That's been keeping me busy. That's done. And I've also recently finished a book that will be published by the Natural History Museum in London. It's called Ancient Sea Reptiles. Now, a couple of years ago, I did, together with the Natural History Museum's Professor Paul Barrett, I did a book called Dinosaurs, How They Lived and Evolved, which is the current kind of industry standard go-to work on, this is our current knowledge of dinosaurs, in terms of everything we understand about their history and their evolution, dinosaurs, how they lived and evolved. And I've always wanted to do a similar book on Mesozoic marine reptiles.
Nice.
So at the same time as dinosaurs are the kind of most prominent group of animals on land. In the seas, you've got the long-necked plesiosaurs and the shark-shaped ichthyosaurs and other groups as well. Obviously, the mosasaurs, this group of swimming lizards in the Cretaceous. And I've submitted many proposals to try and get a book like that off the ground and was always unsuccessful. And until now, because, yes, I've done it. And that will be out early next year. Yeah, so ancient sea reptiles.
Great.
That's a big deal for me.
Congratulations.
Thanks so much. Thank you.
Well, as always, it's always fun to talk to you, Darren. So I'm sorry it took so long to get you back on here.
It is. Yeah.
Well, no worries. I really appreciate it. It was great talking to both of you. Thank you for having me.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
Today, you heard an interview with Darren Naish talking about his art project trying to document all of the cryptids described by Bernard Heuvelmans. Darren's work is available at his Patreon page. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. Monster Talk's a proud member of the Airwave Media Podcast Network, home of such shows as When Things Go Wrong, Legends of the Old West, and Food with Mark Bittman. If you'd like to advertise on this show, contact sales at advertisecast.com. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the very best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. We have links there to our Patreon page as well as a donation button. Another great way to support the show is to buy books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones, and we love Kindle so we can share our digital libraries with each other. And finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please share our show on your favorite social media platforms. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. As always, thank you so much for making Monster Talk a part of your listening life.
Been a Monster House presentation.